We'll open up the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation for Thursday, November 19th. Thank you all for joining us today. We have a little bit of business to take care of first. Our original meeting, we did not have a quorum for adopting our committee rules. Members, these are the same rules that the other committees are utilizing for the interim. And I assume you've had a chance to look at all the, you know, the sneaky things that are in here, but I just haven't found them yet. Anyway, I would entertain a motion to approve.
I move approval of the rules.
Senator Starr has moved adoption of the committee rules. Any questions? Any objections? All right, so ordered. Today, members, we're going to have updates on a number of bills that we have passed, as well as issues that we have been following, and try to get a sense of where we are with those and how they may or may not impact our upcoming work in the February session, and, of course, going forward to the 2011 session. With that, I may open up an informational hearing on the update of status of transportation projects funded by House Bill 2001, and ask that Doug Tindall and whoever he would wish to bring, if anyone with him, forward.
Thanks, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. Good morning. Doug Tindall, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Transportation, here with glad to bring good news to you today. As the House Bill 2001 passed, the intent of the bill was clear to us, I think, that the legislature wanted to put people back to work. And I can tell you that already House Bill 2001 is doing that. Just a, kind of an aside, not all related to House Bill 2001, but in the for the work done in July, August, and September of this year, the Oregon Department of Transportation paid out to contractors just slightly less than $270 million. Over a quarter of $1 billion was paid out in 3 months, and that's putting people to work. Part of that was Jobs and Transportation Act. As the bill passed, we knew that, again, as I said, the intent was to put people to work, and we didn't wait. If you remember, the funding for Section 64 comes from the gas tax, which starts after two improvement quarters in the economy or on January 1st, 2011. So that has not gone into effect yet. What we were able to do is, with cash that we had that would be used for payments to contractors past 2011, we're spending that cash, and then we'll reimburse that cash when we sell the bonds after 2011, when the gas tax kicks in. So we didn't wait around. We're moving forward on the projects. There's three projects that are already in construction that have been let, that have been let for contract. And and the rest of the projects we're moving forward on. Now, the chart that you've got, and I'll take just a minute to kind of walk you through that. The chart that you've got shows the project name, the ODOT region in which it exists, a description of the project, the total cost, the funds that are provided by House Bill 2001, the funds that are needed to complete, what plan we have to fund any gap that exists, and then a project completion date and current status. Now, this chart will turn into something more easier to read, I guess. And what we plan for the January update, we come back to you quarterly and with updates on this. And what we plan for the update is to have a standard format, a couple of pages on each project, contains a little more detail on the project description and on the current status of the project. And where we're headed with that will be the information that will be available to people when they go to the web page. There was a web page that's required in the bill, and to give us the opportunity to tell people what the status of projects are. You'll notice as you read down the list of estimated completion date that there are a lot of unknowns. We need to improve this a little bit in the sense that completion dates are really not known until a project is let. That's one factor. The second factor is a lot of some of these projects are not completely defined yet. We're working with the locals to define them. Some of these projects have not gone through the entire environmental process, and we don't have a completion date there. So we're going to look for and possibly adding another date that's a construction start date and then an estimated completion date. So the construction start date would be filled in. The estimated completion date may still be unknown until we actually get it under contract. I'd be glad to answer or try and answer any questions. I know the general statistics about the projects. I said three are in construction, many are in design already. The only other thing that I'd like to update you on is that in the bill, there were 37 projects identified in Section 64, and then there were 12 governmental entities also defined with an allocation of funds, and the task to go off and identify projects for those funds and go through the Area Commission and the Oregon Transportation Commission for approval. That process was required to be completed by July 1st of 2010. I'm happy to tell you it's been completed already. The commission gaveled down on 14 projects in those political subdivisions at their last meeting. So all the projects are identified. There's 51 in total. And we look forward to continuing to report. I think procedurally, the way the budget note was written, I need to ask for your acceptance of this report and look forward to coming back every quarter to give you another one. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. First of all, can I have a motion to accept the report and then we'll ask for questions?
So moved.
Senator Starr has moved to accept the receipt of this report. Any objections to that? Okay, we have been in receipt. Questions for Mr. Tindall? Senator Berger.
Thank you. I see that you have requested a federal earmark for $30 million on the Dundee-Newburgh bypass. What is your sense about earmarks at the federal level? Do you think that that's going to come to pass, or you think that they're not going to have earmarks?
Chairman Metzger, Senator Berger, that's a really tricky question. I'll give you my opinion. There's been a lot of rhetoric, or there's been some rhetoric, about getting rid of earmarks at the federal level. The reality, though, I can't imagine that goes away. It maybe changes. Maybe you have some sorts of categories of projects of regional significance or national significance. It's hard for me to imagine a federal bill with absolutely no earmarks in it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions, Mr. Tindall? No, it's early, but I have one, Doug, unrelated to these particular projects, but one of the issues that we have in 2001 that there's a lot of concern about on the committee was our creative approach to coming up with a fix for Cornelius Pass Road. And so what's one thing I will continue to press on? I kind of want to know, just since it is hardly, it's not really defined, but it provides a way to start getting some analysis of the issue and people's outside-the-box thinking that they might bring to us for possible funding. Has any work been done on developing that protocol for reaching out to the private sector on that?
Yeah, Chair Metzger, thank you for the question. What we're doing is we have a study. There was a safety audit of sorts that the county did, and we're working with the county. We are working on preparing an RFP, request for proposals, or request for qualifications probably is actually the way it's going to go. But we want to make sure that we don't redo work that's already been done in the safety audit. So I was unaware of the safety audit or the breadth of the safety audit when we were during the session, and I don't think it was completed during the session. And we have it now, and so the idea in general that we're still pursuing is to go out and get three or four, some number of consultants, pay them a stipend, not a large stipend, but pay them a stipend to go off and come back to us with, well, for $1 million you could fix this. For $2 million, you could fix this and this, and kind of a stratification so that we can lay out for the legislature, for the county, what are the possibilities here, and what can we do for small amounts of money that can improve safety on that road. So we are working on that. We don't I don't think I've got a scheduled timeline for issuance of that request for qualification yet. It's sometime next spring, I think.
Well, one thing that, to move a little stronger on that, I think the thing was, and please interrupt me if any of those who've been talking about this issue have a different idea, is that a potential solution may cost a significant amount of money, not just the one or two. We had a presentation to this committee in session of 2007, and again, the numbers were unknown, but when Multnomah County was talking to do the kind of fix that would might be necessary to actually meet the traffic needs and the safety needs, it could be $40 million or whatever. So because of the fact that this is an important corridor and it's growing and will continue, and that it doesn't also make a lot of sense to throw good money after bad when you have an environmental limitation because of the way that road is designed and everything else to put something up that really doesn't do much or continues to create problems because it is not designed to do what it will be continually utilized. And so, part of the thought of these folks is, and I think in part of the direction would be, providing the different scenarios of what we see traffic being in the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years on that particular corridor, because there's no other roads there unless there's some designs that I haven't seen or some change of pattern that all of a sudden the Vista Ridge Tunnel, they're going to do trucks again. Assuming none of that's the case, then, what are the pressures that are going to be put on that particular 6-7 miles of road, and then use your creative mind to tell us what would it take to improve safety and traffic flow to meet that projection, because that's not going to be $1 or $2 million.
Okay.
And it's just going to be a critical thing, and we don't really want to band-aid it, but because of the fact that we haven't done that kind of analysis of it, either the county, which is the owner of it, or Columbia or Washington, he primarily uses it, and the industrial people who use it, and then the safety issues that we hear about all the time, that hasn't been addressed. But if we can get something tangible, that one of those oh my God moments, that's a great idea, and this is what's going to cost, so then we can then have something we can touch and feel and put our heads together about how and who will put together the funding to make it happen.
Okay.
So I don't think that the committee is interested in a $1 to $4 million off the guardrail here or something, because that isn't going to meet the need. It needs to be totally looked at differently, and use our creative minds in the private sector without us telling them what that design is.
Right.
You tell us what you would do, and it might be a $5, $10, $50, or $60 million thing. What would you do to make this last 20, 25 years?
Right. We'll make sure that's part of the RFQ, but I probably did a little bit of a disservice by starting so low. The idea was to get those kinds of answers. Is there something that you can do for $1 or $2 million that's not a throwaway that would improve it now and complement what we're going to do, what we're going to have to do in the future? So we will make sure that's part of that RFQ.
Okay. Thank you. Here's Dirk.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I'm not going to beat around the bush. The road needs to be widened and straightened, bottom line. You got to widen and straighten that road. It's dangerous now, and it's a major freight corridor as it relates to hazardous material movements. It's a critical link from North Portland to Washington County and the businesses that are served in Western Washington County. I would hope that the RFP recognizes the fact that the road's got to be widened and straightened.
Okay.
That's the only thing that you're going to do there. You can put guardrails up to keep people from sliding off into the off this edge, but those are $1 and $2 million kinds of things. But at the end of the day, the road's got to be widened and straightened, and that's going to require right-of-way acquisition, and it's difficult. The terrain is crummy to do that. But that's where we want to use the private sector, opportunity for innovation and creativity to figure out a way to do this in a way that maybe we hadn't thought of before.
Okay.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, I'm just looking at your chart on Region 2, for instance. The average completion date is probably 2016. The Newburgh-Dundee Highway Bypass, which is basically a rural highway, is projected in 2019. These dates seem way out there to me for something that has the money, that have been in the planning stages. How do we shorten these timelines so that we're not sitting here 10 years from now before we actually have a road that somebody could use for money that they're paying today?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, thanks for the question. This was kind of our first pass at this, and we took a conservative approach at this because I've never been yelled at when I deliver something early. What we will do as we work these projects through design and through the environmental process, when we get to the point of we know what it is we're building, we will look at opportunities for design build, for a practice that we're using on the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene called Construction Management General Contractor. And those types of things can shorten those times. The times that you see here are our conservative guess using our traditional method of delivery. But that's, we don't know that these are going to lend themselves to any other method of delivery, but they certainly can. And I can tell you, in our experience on the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene, by going construction manager, general contractor, we actually work, even though the design's not complete, we know where the piers of the bridge are going in the river, and we were able to take advantage of this year's in-water work window and start that construction. And that's how you can speed projects up. And we will look at all that.
Thank you. Doug, do you see anything that the legislature could do to expedite some of these things? Is there procedural things that are holding things up? I guess anecdotally, no real evidence, but anecdotally, it seems like other states are able to respond a little quicker on building, especially rural-type infrastructure, than we are. Is there actions that we could take as a legislature, now that we have these resources, to speed up the process for the Department of Transportation and get those projects on the ground faster?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I believe that the statutes for procurement allow us, they were just rewritten a couple years ago, and I think they allow the department enough latitude, and we have taken advantage of those innovative methods of contracting. It's a matter of us gaining experience because it changes the risk profile for the contractor and for the state. And you got to make sure that you manage and understand where the risk is going to lie as you go into one of those contracts. But I will think about that, Senator. Nothing springs to mind immediately that would help us streamline that. I think we have the tools in the toolbox.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Schrader.
Just a little bit of follow-up. As I'm looking at the Region 1 projects and actually taking a look at timelines, there are a lot of unknowns in that particular column, in particular the Sunrise Corridor piece. And having had some history with that project in the past, I'm kind of curious as to the status, the phasing, I guess, conversations that have been going on, and also, again, not seeing a date certain for any kind of completion, not only for that project, but for a number of critical projects in Region 1. So perhaps we can just get some information for the record.
Chair Metzger, Senator Schrader, with respect to the Sunrise in particular, we're working with local government and other stakeholders up there to determine how best to spend the money that we've got. What's the best thing we can do with the dollars that we have? You see unknown in a lot of those places on that project and in a lot of those places because it's going to take us some time to figure that out. What you will see in the future as we roll into my intention is the January report, you'll see a little bit better timeline that will tell you when's the decision going to get made. So when am I going to know? I had that question from a representative last week. Okay, I understand. It was on the Troutdale project. I understand that you don't know what you're going to do yet, but when are you going to know what you're going to do? And we're going to put that more level detailed timeline in there so you'll have a better idea about when you can expect to see decisions and see that project move forward.
Thank you, because I am aware there have been many iterations of that project. And again, would like to see some finality, you know, in terms of its certainty when it's actually going to occur.
Senator Metzger, Senator Schrader, I won't be able to tell you exactly what's going to happen, but I'll try and tell you when it's going to happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Senator.
Unrelated to Section 64. Is that?
Sure. Go ahead.
This has to do with Section 23.
Give me a hint.
You don't have every section of this filter memorized? It's the section related to the pilot project and contracting, not the maintenance. And I just, I would like to, as that the rulemaking process goes forward, the rules I'm required, I think there's a February 1 deadline in that section. I'd like to be apprised of that process going forward. That's all I asked at this point. You don't need to answer. I mean,
okay.
If you have information off the top of your head, you can provide it to me. But
I actually do.
Otherwise, I'd like to continue to be apprised of how that's moving ahead.
Okay. Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, and the rest of the committee, just to let you know, the section of highway that we selected was a section of Oregon 219 west of Woodland, going up to Shoals Ferry Road. We took in a lot of factors, some of them wanting to be relatively close to urban areas where you had good access to supplies, areas that didn't have so much snowfall that would require the purchase of a snowblower, which is just that's an unreasonable thing to expect. But ones that took into urban-rural kind of mix, sort of a suburban sort of a roadway, and so. That's the section of road, and I will get you more detailed information on the RFQ. We are pretty much on time, on the timeline we laid out to get that out in February, and I'll get you an update on that.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Doug. Doug will stay right there and put his next uniform on and ask Mr. Tyndall to give us a update on developing standards for practical design, which was another element that we included in 2001, the goal of which is to put our engineering books on the table and actually use the brains and come up with some solutions that might necessarily be less expensive to produce the outcome that we would always want anyway, but to save money and do it in a way that meets the need of that particular project. So, Doug, take her away again.
Thanks. Just for the record, Doug Tyndall, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Practical design has been actually an exciting thing for the department. It's enabled us to bring together a number of pieces of that fit into kind of the practical design concept that we'd already done, and it's enabled us to go beyond those things. I'll tell you what. As we've worked through this, the context that you were putting practical design in is practical design is about bringing the greatest benefits to the entire transportation system. Typically, we look at standards on a project-by-project basis, and you don't think about, well, if I can do something smaller, if I can do a little bit less on this project, that means I've got money to do some other project, and the net result of those, if I can get 90% of the benefits for 75% of the money on Project A, then I've got I can get 70% of the benefits for 25% of the money on Project B. And the net result is I got more benefit. The citizens of Oregon got more benefit than they would have had we just done one project and spent all the money in one place. So it's the practical design concept as we're implementing it is to look for that broader look, to look overall, look at a system basis and the total benefits rather than looking at benefits on individual projects. What we've done, I can give you an example of one thing that we've done in this state with the cooperation of FHWA. Some of the things that we're doing under practical design will take the cooperation of FHWA because they maintain standards on federal aid roads, which almost all of the state highways are. And Mr. Phil Ditzler is here, the division administrator is here in the audience. I hope he's raising his hand. And I want to thank him for his help on moving forward with practical design and really we're going to be pushing the boundaries from Oregon, and I'm hope pushing up to something that we'll see on the national level. One thing that we've done already in the stimulus projects is we went into a strategy where if you had a section of roadway that needed to be resurfaced, where the pavement was failing or was going to fail, the typical process that you would go through is you would look at that, let's just say, 10-mile section of road, and you'd say, okay, I'm going to repave this 10-mile section of road. And then you'd go and you'd look at all of the highway furniture, all the appurtenances around there, the guardrail, the signs, and all of the other things that are around there, and you'd say, are they up to current standard? And if not, you'd bring them up to current standard. What we were able to negotiate in the stimulus funding to stretch those dollars is with FHWA is if we're only going in to pave the road, if that's what really needs to be done, and you have other features that are not standard but are not a safety hazard. In other words, I've got a section of guardrail that hasn't been hit in 20 years. It's not up to standard, but it hasn't ever been hit. Well, we're not going to do that. We're just going to pave. Same project, if I have, or same length of project, if I have a road that needs to be paved and I've got a section of guardrail that gets hit all the time and it's not up to standard, we're going to bring it up to standard. Because in implementing practical design, we are not going to compromise safety. We will not do anything. ODOT will not take on a project that results in less, in lower standard of safety than you have today on any piece of road. It will always either keep it the same or it'll improve it. And that's a discussion that's continuing with the FHWA. They've been so supportive, in fact, that the FHWA actually funded a peer exchange in Oregon where three states came physically, one by phone. And we had some of our external stakeholders at the meeting as well as ODOT staff and participated in a discussion about how this concept, this practical design concept, is implemented in their states. And that gave us some really good information. Some of the things, because every state is different, some things we won't implement here, but some things we will. And some things we'll do differently that they haven't implemented either. An example of that is Missouri said that they, on much of their rural much of their highway system in general, they were going away from paved shoulders back to gravel shoulders. Well, that doesn't work in a bicycle oriented state like Oregon. We're going to have paved shoulders. But, you know, how we do that, we may do that differently than we have in the past, with still ensuring safety for motorists and bicyclists alike. So what we've done is we're moving rapidly on this, and we have had that peer exchange. We had a meeting just a couple of weeks ago with a lot of the project delivery staff, and the question that we asked the project delivery staff is, what do you need to be comfortable implementing practical engineering? What we're finding is, or practical design, what we're finding is that engineers really want to engineer, and as the chair said, that's what this is about, is letting them engineer and not just reading out of a book. But they need to know what is the context in which they're engineering. In other words, what's the rest of that route going to look like? What's the environment around that route? What does the community want? And you need to know all of that information. And then you need to understand how far you can deviate from the standards, what's acceptable, what still gives you an acceptable result. And so that's been our focus, is trying to frame those things for our staff so that they can go off and do what they're really good at, because we do employ good engineers, and they like to engineer. And so we're trying to give them a parameter they can work in and be comfortable working in. In my testimony, I've got a timeline laid out that we may not quite make December 1st for the final practical design strategy, kind of the final internal strategy, but we're very close. And we will send that out then to our external partners and do some review and see if we've missed anything, that particularly the ones that were at the peer exchange. And we'll probably send that to FHWA, certainly, to see if it's consistent with what other states are doing. And then it's just a matter of rollout, and we will deliver the report. But this is a good news story from my perspective. This direction has helped the agency move forward, I believe. And I guess I kind of apologize for not thinking about it on my own, but we appreciate the intent of the legislature, and we think we can implement this and institutionalize this within ODOT and deliver better benefits for the overall transportation system. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Doug, thank you for your report. You know, one thing that I think would be very valuable, and we had talked about this ourselves earlier, is moving forward on this as you develop practical design standards and keeping the legislature so they really understand what you have implemented and the process for selecting the whatever protocols that you select to implement that. As that is then utilized on various state projects, I think it would be very valuable to have an extensive log of how these projects were utilized with the practical design process, to be able to compare those particular projects with similar projects of earlier times in which that particular standard was not applied, and see if we can illustrate the practical differences between building that 8 miles of roadway flat here and have very similar 8 miles applying a practical design standard or whatever, so we could actually have something that we can measure the impacts of how we did it before, how we did a very similar thing today. I think that's not only important for the Legislative Assembly, I think it also is important for your engineers because, you know, they want to focus on delivering something, you know, cleaner, with less expense in today's dollars than it would have been before. And I think it also is extremely valuable in our communication with the public, you know, that we can, anytime that we can demonstrate that that we're open to change, we're open to doing things better, and that we can show some results from that. Right? So I think just going forward, that would be very valuable.
Excellent suggestion, Chair Metzger. In fact, at the workshop, we talked quite a bit about how do we document this and show where the decisions are getting made and how that impacted it. So, excellent suggestion.
Question from Mr. Kendall on practical design. Okay. Thank you, Doug. Kelly Taylor and Betsy Imholt will come forward with a informational meeting on high-speed rail federal funding. And Kelly, I have to apologize. I just, every time I hear the word high speed, I laugh. high speed is means you can't run quite fast enough to catch the train. That's what it means out here. I mean, you know, when you tell somebody high speed and they say 180, 190, no, you know, maybe 25 once in a while. But anyway.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Rail Division, and with me today is Betsy Imholt, who's also working with the Rail Division. And we are going to cover both an update for the federal funding that's been allocated for passenger rail, as well as the rail assessment we've been doing at the legislature's direction. It's interesting when you say high speed, and what I've tried to get people to say, in fact, I heard Mr. Boardman, the CEO of Amtrak, say, you know, it's really higher speed, not necessarily high speed, and because each corridor is different, and it doesn't always lend itself to go 190 or 200 or 250 miles an hour. It may be 90 miles an hour up to 110. So you're right. It is funny when people say high speed, what they conjure up in their mind. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or ARRA, as some people call it, allocated an unprecedented amount of money towards passenger rail. I mean, Amtrak has been struggling for years to even stay afloat at all. And within a few months of taking office, President Obama allocated inside of ARRA $8 billion for passenger rail, specifically higher speed passenger rail. And so the Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA, has had their hands full because they're not, with all of this, because they're not typically used to handing out funds. Aviation, public transit, highway, all of those components of USDOT and everything, they're used to it. But FRA is typically a safety regulator with a loan program to do some infrastructure, but they're not typically into the grant program. So they've really had to come up to speed quickly on this. And it's interesting, the President has said a couple of times, and Secretary LaHood, that the $8 billion is considered a jump start, that this, they want this to be an ongoing program. The President has talked about having $1 billion each of the next 5 years in budget. And interestingly enough, congressional leaders and the President in different packages have been even talking about different amounts above $1 billion, even up to $50 billion, potentially in the next version of safety load. So clearly there's a lot of discussion and interest in upgrading the country's passenger rail system. What that has done, FRA has put out guidelines, et cetera, and had to come up with the program framework and has been looking for, urging the states to go for strategic investments towards true tangible benefits, something that will show fruition quickly. And they have two rounds of applications that they put together. The first one, the applications were due in August, is a two-year window, things that can be done in a two-year window. They're looking for the low-hanging fruit, things that perhaps already have the preliminary engineering and the environmental work done, although you could apply for that, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. And then the second round, where the applications were due in October, was a five-year window for completion of projects, so you could apply for PE, NEPA, and construction. Well, the Pacific Northwest, as you know, is one of, between Eugene and Vancouver, B.C., with the state of Washington and the British Columbia province, has one of the 10 federally designated high-speed rail corridors. We are one of the 10. And when Congress designated that many years ago, they were talking about incrementally up to 110 miles an hour. And the new guidelines that have come out talk about, well, there could be corridors that go up to 125 or something higher than that. But when they designated, they were talking about incrementally up to 110. The corridor that we currently have and we operate on, and we operate two round trips, the state pays for two round trips between Eugene and Portland that then connect up with trains going further into Washington and up to B.C. There are two trains in Oregon, four trains in the state of Washington, run by the state of Washington, and then one with Amtrak, but the Co-Starlight that comes up from L.A. through Seattle. Our corridor right now is at the highest speed is 79 miles an hour. And in our 124 miles between Eugene and Portland, there's only 6 miles that can actually go 79 miles an hour. Most of it, the average speed is around 40. So you're right. We're not at high-speed rail. We are at the incremental stage. So what we've done, we did apply. Oregon did put applications in. So did Washington. We've worked very closely with both Washington because we share the corridor with partners. We always have, but we've really worked hard on these applications together. And with the affected railroads. Union Pacific is the main railroad in Oregon, and Burlington Northern, BNSF, is the one in Washington. And so we worked very closely with them. The Rail Advisory Committee weighed in on what projects we should put in for. We applied under both rounds. In the first round, we applied, they're both pretty similar, 10 projects, about 9 or 10 projects, congestion-related, and they are freight-related projects because we run on the freight system. The passenger trains run on the freight system. So if you can make freight improvements that then benefit passenger rail, the time and the performance, then it's an eligible project. And there were projects in the Portland Triangle area between the different yards and the border of Washington that were identified as congestion projects that would have tangible benefits, one in the Eugene area. And then also the thing that Betsy's going to talk a little bit about when we get to the study is where best to perhaps position the passenger trains in the future. We looked at the feasibility of, do you stay on the Union Pacific line, or is there another line available? What could you do, or a combination thereof? And I'm going to let her talk about that. But the project to study that, to do the environmental work, was part of our applications. In the first round that was due in August, we applied to do preliminary engineering and the NEPA work for those 9 or 10 projects. I think it's 10. And in the second round, we applied again for PE, NEPA, and construction because, again, one's a two-year window and one's a five-year window. Now, originally, FRA was saying that they would tell us about the first round. And by the way, the ask is enormous. In the total that was asked for is $57 billion in about 26 states. And the applications were very, very, very comprehensive. So the FRA's got their hands full looking through a lot of paper. Our application is literally from the floor up to my knee. That's how deep it is. That's how much paper it was. I mean, it was done electronically, but that's how much paper it is. When I talked to another state, they had over 3,400 pieces of paper. It was a lot of documentation about past information, et cetera, that had to be put in there. What we've heard for when they're going to make a decision, at first they were going to allocate out of the first round and allocate the second round, and now they've decided to look at them together. And it's moved from, we'll tell you in 45 days, to the fall, to the winter. And what we're hearing now is that it will be winter, and they're going to do both at the same time. I don't know that they're going to allocate all $8 billion. They may hold some of it back, but they're looking at it. And we believe it will be sometime between January 1 and February 15th, which would make sense since February, mid-February, is sort of the anniversary of the ARRA package, and I'm sure that they're looking at getting something going. But this has really been a huge amount of work for them. They did not get extra staff to deal with this, and they had to create a program on the run and hold regional meetings and stuff. It's been very interesting. Our total application is about $2.3 billion, and combined with Washington, it's about $3.6 billion, and that's for our corridor. I will tell you, California has the potential of a large amount of match, which is they'd like to have. I mean, the FRA is looking for to help match. And I think California's, what, $4
billion? $4.7.
$4.7 billion. So, you know, and there's a lot of states out there well-positioned, the Chicago area, North Carolina, and some of the others. So the competition is going to be fierce. But what they've told us repeatedly is this is a jump start. This is going to be an ongoing program. There are going to be subsequent rounds. If you don't make it in the first round, there's going to be other rounds. We want you to continue to apply. You can continue to improve your application if something was missing or something wasn't quite as great as it could have been. But everybody scrambled. This caught everybody by surprise because, again, Amtrak's been struggling, et cetera, and passenger rail hasn't been growing. But we believe, both we and Washington believe, we have a good story to tell on our corridor because we've been up and running for over 10 years. Both states have done a very good job of supporting the service and keeping funding coming and making improvements. We have about the seventh highest ridership in our corridor in the country, even though we're not one of the most populated areas. Our ridership continues to grow every single year. So with that, I will stop on that. And I'll turn it over to Betsy to do the other one, unless you have a question about this right now.
Well, I have one,
mm-hmm.
And that is, I appreciate your work on that. And you're right, this is a extremely competitive process for tens and tens of billions of dollars of projects of which there is a single-digit allocation. And, you know, as I was reading over some of the applications and I was in Oklahoma a couple of months ago, and there happened to be an article about that there from the governor there. And you're looking at some of those Midwest states, you mentioned Chicago, where there are 8 to 10 different states have gone together to make the applications, you know, to compete against little old Oregon. And, you know, you've got the governors of 8, you know, states all signing together for a project, not to mention California and others. It would seem on the surface that our chances would be very slim with that kind of united horsepower. But I'm glad we're going forward and looking for that. I guess my question would be, regardless of how this particular round shows up, how you see from this body, the legislative body, what, if anything, that we can do to help make you stronger down the road. Are there any things missing from the legislative perspective that allows the division to be more competitive?
Mr. Chair, I would say that we have legislative authority, obviously, to have the trains and to do the projects and things like that. To be honest with you, if it turns out that we need to go and do some more work, additional environmental work or something like that, or some sort of positioning that we weren't quite as ready, it may be a funding issue because the funds that I have are not typically project related. It's regulation, and they come from the railroads, which is, you know, why the legislature funded the study that Betsy's going to talk about. So it actually could come down to we need to do some more work. They want us to flesh something out a little further, and there's a funding. It could be that. I don't think it will become statutory authority. I think it will be probably more, if anything, a funding issue.
Okay. Go ahead, Betsy.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Eimholt, and I'm with the ODOT Rail Division. In 2007, you all approved the rail division doing a big statewide study of the rail network in Oregon, which, as you know, is mostly a privately owned network. The study is very comprehensive. It's looking at what we have now, how it's being used, how it might be used in the future. It's looking at the challenges that the future poses to the system, as well as the opportunities that are out there. The study looks at both passenger and freight-related issues. On the passenger side, we looked at intercity passenger rail, the project that Kelly was alluding to, looking at where to best run the passenger trains in the future. Right now, we're on the Union Pacific Main Line, which is a busy freight line. And if you're here in Salem, that is the line that runs along 12th Street. And is there an opportunity to possibly relocate those same Amtrak trains to another line in the Willamette Valley? There's the Oregon Electric Line, which it's commonly referred to, which is a 100-year-old line that runs on Front Street. So a visual for you to picture. We have looked at that. We think that there are some good things that could happen from moving the trains. However, it's not without its long list of pros and cons on both lines. And although we think it merits further looking into, we have made no decisions and have actively engaged with all of the communities along the line to know that we're looking at this, because obviously for some who aren't used to very much train activity, it might be cause some concern, and we recognize that, and so we've been engaging with them on that. We would like to, part of our federal application was to get the money to do a full environmental impact statement of that question of where these trains should be, and that would include a full alternatives analysis and the 13, I think, technical studies that go along with that, including noise and vibration and historical, cultural resources, et cetera. Meanwhile, we also are looking at commuter rail extending the West service to Salem, and we will be having a report on that shortly. On the freight side, which is really where the bulk of the reports will spend most of its time, because frankly it's what we know the least about, is that we're looking at the state of the infrastructure, the movements that happen today, and the lines that are at risk. Just to put something in perspective for you, over half of the train miles that exist in Oregon are on the short line network. The short line network is vast and pretty well built, especially in the Willamette Valley. However, it only carries 15% of all the freight movements in the whole state. So we think that there are some opportunities there to really plan to have that better used in the future. In some of these short lines, for example, there's one train a week on them. So it's sitting there. It's a highway. And in many cases, it's empty 6 days out of seven. So we're looking at ways that we could really boost that in the future and provide opportunities for planners that could enable its better use as the population grows. We expect the report to be out after the first of the year, and I expect that we'll get to come back and talk to you more about all the results.
Is she here now? She can't be here.
Thank you.
Any questions for Betsy?
Mr.
Yeah, Senator George.
Betsy, and I guess this is for Kelly, too. One of the things I think is probably most frustrating from my perspective is that when I think of rail, I think about moving heavy things in a very dense way and getting trucks off of freeways. And when I travel quite a bit overseas, and when I see transportation systems that work for moving people, I see a heavy reliance on bus services. Like you go to Turkey, for instance, you can get to Turkey, and in Turkey you can get anywhere on a bus super fast, very inexpensively. And I look at, like, for instance, extending west from Wilsonville to Salem, that would replace very efficient, very well used bus lines that are low cost and incredibly flexible. So as a business owner who ships a lot of product out of the state of Oregon, we've had to pretty much go away from rail completely because the freight system hasn't been such. I actually put things on trucks and shipped them to British Columbia to get on rails. And I guess what I'm kind of stuck here on is that I understand that the federal government is talking about passenger rail, but it seems like what you're doing is you're taking a round peg and trying to stick it in a square, or vice versa. it really seems to me that we've got a problem with trying to get our businesses to use a freight system and get those trucks off the highways and then use the highway system to move people in very efficient ways in like maybe longer distance buses that are way less cost and much more flexible. How is that interacting with federal government? Because just to slap in high-speed rail, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Europe this summer, and they're actually seeing a huge reduction in their high-speed rail usage because people are flying now. And the air system has been developed so much in Europe that people in Europe are going away from rail and into air flight to move around between countries. And so it seems like to me it's kind of like going down a path where if we took those same resources, we could really move a lot of freight back onto the rail system and help the entire transportation system.
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Senator George, there's a couple things I want to say. On the look at commuter rail is a feasibility versus a proposal or a recommendation. There's been a lot of interest about, gee, if it's up and running, wouldn't the next stop be Salem? And so people have asked us to look at that. In fact, the legislature asked us to look at that. And so we have. To be honest with you, at this point, I mean, the study's not done, but we've done lessons learned, we've done interviews, we've looked at it. I think there's really some serious challenges to try to expand commuter rail down to Salem, and most notably the interest of the railroad itself to have the commuter rail any further impact on its system, because they believe, and from their records, it has impacted their freight ability or negatively impacted them to be able to move freight as freely as they'd like to. Because commuter rail is a very intense operation, you know, at certain peak hours. So I think that both from a cost, a railroad agreement, things like that, that it may not be that may be the logical in some people's mind next step, but not as easy as people think it would be to do. So I don't really, honestly, in my view, see commuter rail happening to Salem anytime soon, to be honest with you. I mean, that's just what I'm seeing so far. I would say as far as the intercity passenger rail, you're right. I think buses locally can do some things pretty quickly. And Turkey's a large country, so I'm not saying that that's all local. I'm just saying that our bus system isn't necessarily long distance as robust as it could be. Greyhound's cut back quite a bit through the years. We've lost a lot of routes. I think that the passenger trains we're talking about, if we did the study that Betsy was talking about, is talking about intercity, the long-distance trains. And I think there's a market there, although we do supplement with buses on the valley for the trains we don't have that match up to Seattle and the trains going to Seattle out of Portland. So we have a mixture of buses and trains in the valley. I think the one piece I want to say is, so I agree with you, I think buses and trains have their niche. I don't think one is always the substitute for the other. But what I would say is, if there was an upgrade, and whether it was the Union Pacific line or the Oregon Electric line, but particularly if it's the Oregon Electric line, you do that sort of upgrade in order to run the passenger trains. And if you did move them, or move them to the most part, because I think we'll still have to touch the Union Pacific line in Eugene and the Albany area and obviously the Portland area to get into Washington. So we're never going to be completely off of it. But if you could do that, you do improve freight stability capacity right away. And you've improved both freight capacity on the Union Pacific line and the Oregon Electric line, because you've upgraded it beyond what they can afford to do, but that they would need in order to do some more business. One of the things we're looking at in the study, and Betsy can talk about this probably better than I can, is we are looking at the commodity flow, and we've also compared rail commodity flow with truck commodity flow, exactly what you're talking about. And what the early findings right now that we're looking at, I just heard this yesterday, is the valley between the Eugene to Portland is extremely congested with truck movement and rail movement, and it's intra-Oregon rail movements. And it's interesting that it's a switch between eastern Oregon and the valley and back and forth. I mean, there's some real correlation between the movements. And that's the sort of thing we're finding in the study. And you're right. We need to find a way to be able to encourage it to go on to rail and have an infrastructure that can support it and deliver it on time so that you're not having to take it on truck to get it somewhere that you can get it efficiently on rail. I would like to make that happen in Oregon. That's what I think this study is going to show us, is where the opportunities are, how we could mitigate the problem that we have, or the fact that something's dying off and we don't want it to, or we want, everything's not going to be on the I-5. not all businesses, they're rural businesses, how we can make hubs that would do an intermodal efficiently so that you don't take your business all the way somewhere else far away in order to get it on the rail. I mean, I think that's exactly, this is going to give us a strategic blueprint for investment, I think.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, if I just might add on one thing, the map that's included in your packet that has a project listed on it, the first page of sheet one of two, those projects are freight congestion relief projects that are what we call the Portland Triangle, which is proportionately more congested than Chicago's freight network is. This is a real problem. And if I just will pick off one example, project number four, which is the curbs between East Portland and Albina, every single train that goes through there has to go 6 miles an hour. Every single train. And that would include any sort of high-speed trains that we would hope to have. So obviously we have that on this list, and we want to fix that desperately, and that would improve mobility for the whole network. And that's just one. These are all fall into that category. So, you know, let's say, you know, we have one big project, which is this whole idea of the really upgrading the whole line for faster speeds. But even if we didn't get that one, any one of these could really improve fluidity, and all of them together. These are projects that have been on the books for a long time on the wish list, and if we could actually move on some of them, it would be great. And this high-speed rail money gives us the opportunity to do that.
Any other questions? Senator George?
Quick follow-up. I guess I appreciate the answer of both of you, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is that when I think about the resource of rail, it's built for heavy, heavy materials. And roads are typically built for lighter vehicles. And it seems like that, and I understand what sort of the political implications of federal money and these kind of things is, it seems like to me it's odd that we take the heavy materials, which are industrial materials, and we put them in trucks, and then we take our dollars and we spend those dollars to put, you know, 180, 200-pound people on these big, massive trains and move them up and up down the valley. It's the weight. I mean, every time we talk about roads, we're talking about weight. Every time we talk about rail, we're talking about weight. And you look at the resource of rail versus roads, and we should be putting lighter weight people on roads and heavier weight freight on trains. And to me, I'm not getting the logic, I guess. I'm just sort of disconnected from kind of what this push is to move passengers onto an infrastructure that is the highest and best use of that infrastructure is using it for freight and figuring out how to get freight off the roads. And I'm just trying to figure out, is the federal government really focused on passenger only? Or are they focused on freight? I mean, it seems like a misallocation of resources.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I agree with you that rail is built and can handle heavy stuff. And I wish more things were moving on rail versus the road, because we all pay for the roads, whereas the other is, you know, the private infrastructure. And it matters if we have congestion. It matters if we have road wear and tear. There's no doubt about it. And I think that rail can move hazardous materials safely, and I prefer that rather than have them on the road. But your observation of so far what has come from the federal government for funding, you're right, has been passenger. They have not done, at this point, other than some tax credit programs and things like that, much in the way of investing in the freight. But the money that they're talking about for passenger rail does make freight investments and will improve things, the congestion thing. They're looking for congestion projects. So it is that even though it's labeled passenger, it ends up being freight benefit because it's freight projects, because it's a freight system that will be done. There may be in California a whole new corridor, but again, they're trying to move gazillions of people compared to what we are. I don't disagree with you. I just think that it does benefit freight. You just have to think about it, that it's a freight system that's being improved to put some trains on it, although it will be beefed up enough to be able to handle more freight better than it is today, and I think it will help freight. Every one of these projects helps freight. I will say that the one thing that I think Oregon has done that many states have not done, because we, in our study, have looked at funding strategies, we've looked at return on investments and things like that. The Connect Oregon program that you all have had and just did a Connect 3 is absolutely known across the country among the railroads. I mean, we have a stellar program, and we have been making some very important freight investments with Connect Oregon And I wish other states to step up, and I'm looking forward to the federal government thinking about perhaps some freight rail investment. It's the one mode. Rail, this is the first time rail is getting any significant investment from the federal side, and so I'm not gonna argue with it. I think it's great. I'd like to see more, and I think that they are talking about more, and I think it will help the freight system. But I wanted to tell you that the railroads think that the Connect Oregon is extremely important because it is making some big freight improvements, both on the short line and the Class 1s. I just wanted to tell you that.
Thank you.
Senator Berger.
Yes. I don't have a question. I'd just like to make a statement, and that is that what a personal pleasure it is for me to see Betsy here today. I get to see the director from time to time, but I don't get to see you often, and it's really a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
When we were looking at the possibility of growing export-import business over on the coast, as you remember, we were hoping to get as many supporters as possible. And one of the impediments would have been the rail line within the city of Salem on 12th Street. And so I'm so glad to hear that you're looking at other options for that. Because if it becomes a reality, and we always hope that it will, as the economy globally improves, that will not be pushback from the city of Salem and its residents about that particular project. So thank you again for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? I have more of a statement than a question. From my perspective, the federal dollars that have been allocated for high-speed rail has more to do with politics than it does with the appropriate use or the correct use of public resources. You're looking at a drive to get folks. It has a lot to do with the movement to getting people off the road, quite honestly, and whether the investments make sense or not, a lot of this has been driven by politics. The same way we spend $200 million a mile for a light rail. Does that make any sense? No, it's all politics. So appreciate very much your coming this morning and the report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have on our agenda a status report for the Columbia River Crossing Project. Director Garrett and Secretary Hammond, Mr. Brandman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Matthew Garrett, the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I want to thank you for allowing us to share what I think is a good story, and we will have three folks sharing different parts of the Columbia River Crossing story. This is a one-of-a-kind project. I would offer that there's not a project in the nation that is similar to the Columbia River Crossing, to the extent that you have extensive highway work, you have light rail that will cross from Expo over into the city of Vancouver. You have bicycle and pedestrian opportunities presenting themselves, all in one structure. You have seven interchanges on the Oregon and Washington side that need to be dealt with. We connect two cities, we connect two states, we connect two countries with this project. And I remind you that this is the I-5 trade corridor, and we have a lift. We have a stoplight. That is the only bridge that lifts on the whole of the corridor, and that has economic and environmental implications. This project is an unprecedented effort between the states of Oregon and Washington. It truly is a partnership, not only with the two states, but all the communities that make up the bridge influence area on the I-5 corridor. It truly is a partnership in the most broad definition of that word. Now, today I am honored to introduce Paula Hammond, who's Washington's Secretary of Transportation. This is a very impressive woman. She's been the director of WashDOT for 2 years. She's been with that agency, I believe, 29 years, which means she started when she was in grade school.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Significant budget, obviously, significant number of FTEs that make sure the transportation system in the state of Washington is safe and efficient. I want you to know a little bit about her. Last month, Secretary Hammond was awarded the ASHTO, and that's the Association of State Transportation and Transportation Officials. She won the President's Award for her work in the areas of communication. This is a very plain speaking woman, crisp in her communications, and the work she does for the nation on climate change issues, as well as just basic leadership. Actually, Paula and WSDOT pretty much walked away with all the awards at the ASHTO meeting. So she runs a fine organization, and I am envious of the way she does her job. But most important, she has her roots from here in the state of Oregon. She's a Klamath Falls girl. She also did her schooling at the great Oregon State University, and she's a professional engineer. So, again, we raised her right. She's over in Washington doing good stuff, but we have her today as a partner in this project and communicating a good story to you. We will speak, as I said, on three different issues. I will kind of share a basic overview, again, to bring us back into the context of what this project is all about. You will recall this is a conversation that is a decade old in the making. So we have been working this, refining this, to getting to the alternatives that we have before us. Ms. Hammond will speak to delivering the Columbia River Crossing, look at the best practices, where we have gone to try to make sure the lessons learned across the nation certainly inform the way we do business here. Then Mr. Brandman will come forward and show where we are going. How are we going to breathe life into this significant project? So what we have, again, as I said, this is a conversation that has been taking place well over a decade. We stand on the shoulders of many. Refer back to the 2001 timeframe when then-Governor Locke and Governor Kitzhaber appointed a 26-member panel of civic leaders, of business people, looking at the challenges within that I-5 corridor. An 18-month process revealed that there were certainly challenges in terms of the economic viability of the region, if not the two states, if not the West Coast. And they identified some solutions, three solutions, to be very honest with you. Deficits up in the state of Washington, the Salmon Creek area. Deficits in the Delta Park area, and then the bridge itself, the Columbia River Crossing. I'm happy to tell you the state of Washington has taken care of Salmon Creek. The Oregon Department of Transportation has taken care of Delta Park as we speak right now. So we stand right at the cusp of breathing life into that third solution that they identified back in the 2001-2002 timeframe, and that's the Columbia River Crossing and that 5-mile bridge influence area. Following on the heels of that conversation, and growing out from all the local inputs and those problems that were identified and those solutions that were offered up, came a 39-member Columbia River Crossing task force, a task force comprised of the breadth and depth of transportation interest, of community interest, of just issues surrounding the economic, the environmental justice type issues of this big complex project. 39 folks. Looking at the challenges, identifying various evaluation criteria as they continued to refine the various alternatives that leads us to the point we stand today. And I would remind you that we started out looking at least 30 different alternatives. So the vetting has been comprehensive. We have whittled down for various reasons for us to meet the purpose and need of a safer bridge, a bridge that deals with congestion, a project that deals with transit deficits. We've looked at all that. We've maintained that principle, that discipline, as we've refined down to the option we have in front of us. Six problems were identified, very simply. You see them listed: congestion, public transit, bicycle and pedestrian issues, freight mobility, seismic risks, and safety. The bottom line is we have spoken to these issues before, colleagues that came before you. Again, we came back in 2002 to begin some conversations with legislative activities, had the privilege of going up to the state of Washington and sharing our thoughts with their Senate Transportation Committee. I think earlier, a joint committee up in Portland, we spoke to the issues right at the early parts of this partnership with the state of Washington. I think then Secretary Doug McDonald and I gave a presentation as to where we were and how we were moving forward. But this is unprecedented to have the Secretary down in Salem in a formal setting having this conversation. We spoke to the issues of congestion. We reminded folks that currently roughly 135,000 folks use that corridor on a daily basis, traveling back and forth across the river. As we project out to the 2030 timeline, we see that growing to about 184 or more folks using this corridor. The significance of that, if we do nothing, the cost of inaction is significant in terms of economic and environmental issues. I will tell you that the peak hours continue to grow. If you drive up in the Portland area and you're migrating up in the I-5 area about 2:30, 3 o'clock, you see the peak. If you're doing the same thing in the morning on the Washington site, you see the peak, totaling 5-6 hours. The cost of inaction is we see those peaks growing to 15 hours a day. The significance of that is not only the good folks stuck in traffic trying to get to and fro. Freight and commerce is stuck in traffic as well. Freight is no longer able to navigate in between those peaks because those peaks have now grown together. Public transit, we have a significant deficit. We have a weak system right now that serves about 3,500 riders today. If we truly animate this project, we grow this to 18,000. We offer people a commute option to get across the river. The bike ped situation, if you've ever rode your bike, and I suggest you don't because it's lousy. It's a goat trail for all intents and purposes, a 4-foot-wide path that's on and off. We will remedy that situation. Speaking a little more depth about freight mobility, again, the economics goes without saying, and I can't emphasize enough the economics surrounding of this. But to put some fast facts or numbers together, today roughly $40 billion crosses that bridge. As we look out to the future, that will increase by a significant amount, up to about a $71 billion total. As we project out, we look to the future, the freight volumes will grow. Some offer that will double within the next 15 to 20 years. The majority of that freight will go by truck. That's just the way it is, roughly 3/4 of it. We have to have a quarter that can accommodate this tsunami of freight coming at us and the mechanism in which it is transferred across and through and throughout the nation. The delivery times, again, will increase if the peaks increase, which means the bottom line. This is tough, and we're disadvantaging businesses along this corridor. Again, we need to open things up to move commerce. We are a region that is trade-dependent. Right at the core of this project are the two ports, the infrastructure delivering the resources of the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, the West Coast, stand right ground zero in this. The benefits, the economic benefits, the environmental benefits cannot be overstated on this. Safety issues, certainly a thread that is woven deeply within this fabric of the project here. The environmental risk. I would remind you that these bridges, there are two bridges currently now, the interstate bridges, one built in 1917, the other one 1958. They certainly don't meet the seismic standards of today. They're obsolete, the lanes are closed, the shoulders are bad. We've talked about the bicycle pedestrian opportunities. The foundations, they're built on timber piling. The lift spans are held together with steel braces. Again, if we should get a major shake, we believe the bridge will be compromised. And again, the implications are enormous on that. So we will address those risks with this project. We will armor up this bridge much like we've armored up the bridges along the I-5 corridor that we replaced with the OT investment. We stand ready to take care of this important bridge. The issue of safety. This is the highest crash location in the state of Oregon. It's twice the average of similar urban-type highways, about a crash a day. And again, as we see problems continuing with the spacing of the interchanges, those weaving actions not only compromise the functionality and the operation of the bridge, but the safety of the bridge. We see that over time growing by as much as 80%, so you're getting close to 700-plus accidents a day. Now, again, the economic implications are tremendous. When there's an accident, it takes time to clear it. People queue up. So in addition to the human suffering that comes with accidents, the injuries, there's an economic. And, again, there's an environmental issue. You start spewing emissions if you're backed up there. We can take care of this with the solution we have at hand. We continue to move forward with regard to safety. It is a foundation upon which we jump off. The Columbia River crossing is a long-term comprehensive solution. Again, I've told you the many moving parts that we have to this bridge. It is a replacement bridge, a bridge that will address the issues of congestion. It will eliminate that stoplight, that bridge lift that happens just about once a day. And it meets the seismic issues that are challenged today. Again, safety woven all through those three improvements. Again, we will certainly increase the transit ridership into Clark County. We will offer commute options to those good folks. Huge improvements in the bicycle and pedestrian facilities. Again, accessibility, commute options, and safety. Substantial investments going toward Marine Drive interchange, a major freight corridor there that we will enhance. And we will improve the economy, and when we improve the movement of freight, we're talking about jobs here. I don't want to forget about that. What's important, if you look at that five-mile bridge influence area from about Columbia Boulevard to SR 500, the movements in there, 75% of the movements getting on and off transition right in that area. So there's a lot of activity. Again, that's where the ports are. That's where the transportation investment and infrastructure has been made to accommodate the flow of commerce, the traded goods that we have in that area. So significant activities in there. I've spoken about the benefits kind of woven through my comments here. The reducing of congestion, the transit opportunities, the freight mobility opportunities, the greenhouse gas emissions that we will reduce, stormwater treatment. We have a bridge that will not dump the chemicals right into the river. We will take care of that. The seismic the deficits will be dealt with, and the issues of safety, we will improve the motorists and the traveling public's ride as they go across that. So the benefits, the opportunities in terms of safety, economics, environmental, the basic operations, the multimodal nature of this bridge, those are opportunities I do not think that we can stand down from. And I want to suggest one more opportunity that we must never forget, because I think the times demand we never forget. With this bridge brings jobs. And when you look at the overall opportunities, we tally up roughly 20,000 jobs for folks as they build this bridge and the collateral benefits that will extend themselves not only to the work that they do on the bridge, but the opportunities that will come to businesses as we advantage them rather than disadvantage them with this facility, and the collateral benefit of business coming in as we grow community opportunities, as we bring light rail over into Vancouver, opportunities at the expo centers. We continue to use that corridor. Certainly we've seen significant community growth with light rail here in the state of Oregon. We see similar opportunities presenting themselves. Again, those put the work boots on the ground. Those generate the businesses and reinvestment in the communities. The project is of national significance. There is no question about it. It's more than just a bridge, as I've articulated. It's good for the state of Oregon. It's good for the state of Oregon, state of Washington. It's good for the West Coast. It's good for the nation. There is no question about it. I'm going to turn my mic over to Secretary Hammond, who again will speak to the best practices, the lessons learned. But the bottom line here, as I emphasized earlier on, this is a partnership. We've taken the community of interest. We have developed a long-term comprehensive solution to the challenges that we face in the I-5 corridor. And now we need to deliver on it. And with that, I'd like Secretary Hammond to take the baton.
Thank you, Matt. Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. I shared with Senator Metzger that I haven't been inside the Capitol building since I was a fifth-grade campfire girl, and true to form, I only remember the cafeteria. So today I'll look around the building a little and try and learn more about Oregon history that I've probably forgotten. We have developed a very strong partnership with ODOT. WashDOT and ODOT together have been working on this project for over 10 years, and what I'd like to talk to you about today is a little bit about how we've been organizing ourselves from the way we've seen large projects being delivered around the country. We've put those practices into place in the state of Washington, have been very successful with our delivery of very high profile projects, which this project certainly is, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that. First is the recognition of this project as a project of national significance. It is one that our USDOT partners are cheering on as we speak, working hard to make sure as USDOT strengthens their ability to be a one DOT between Federal Transit Administration, Federal Highways, and even the environmental permitting parts of the nation's agencies. we've been working hard to be recognized, first of all, as a project that can be a national model, one that we can show how to do it right with environmental streamlining, good coordination from both the transit and highway perspective, the integrated plan that we're developing for the I-5 corridor of both transit, high-capacity transit, and highway, good freight, good commuter trips, is one that's been recognized. Last year in August, Federal Transit Administration and Federal Highways recognized this project and declared us a priority project, which means that they'll be focusing on us, one of 20 projects around the nation, as one that they'll work hard to work through the environmental streamlining and coordination amongst federal agencies. It's very important to us as we work on this kind of a project that we have that kind of cooperation, so we're excited for this opportunity. They felt that it was a project worth watching and supporting because of the issue around regional congestion. They recognize I-5 as a West Coast freight corridor, very important to the economy of both the states along the corridor and the nation's economy. And as we try and pull ourselves out of this economic recession, it'll be very important for us to have these kinds of projects that not only build the jobs that Matt talked about now and create jobs for infrastructure building, but that will help strengthen the economy overall with good transportation as the backbone of our economy. We, in Washington State, about 8 years ago, decided that if we were going to deliver the projects that we were asking our legislature to fund, we needed to know what the good and the bad of other large projects around the country had been. So we went to visit some of those. We went to the Big Dig. We learned what worked and what didn't. We went to Denver's T-Rex, very successful project, Salt Lake City and Los Angeles. We were looking for best practices not only on organizational models, but also on cost estimating, delivery, project management, and I'll share just a few of those with you today. Some of the things that we looked at were the critical areas for project delivery. Any one of these things can trip you up as you start to deliver a large project. We have the environmental and permitting issue that I mentioned is squarely on our radar screen. We also know that the Columbia River Crossing is one that so far doesn't have a lot of funding. Usually you get the money and then you start thinking about how you use that money to the best advantage on the project. This is a project that's been screaming for correction and foreign investment, and we're now trying to build both the plan and the financial plan that will support the delivery of this project. So one of the things that we learned that was most important is around the project management, project delivery, and financial planning. Some of the takeaways we learned from the other projects. First of all, successful projects around the nation have co-located. Not only if it's a bi-state project that Oregon and Washington are sitting together in a project team, but the consultants that we bring in to help us sit with us as well. We are an integrated project team, and we've done that now for several years. The other major issue, which was a lesson learned from a project that didn't go well in Massachusetts, was that the strong owner model is a must. Only the owner can be the owner, and that's the important issue to take away. You can never give away or delegate the issue of the state's or the federal investment that you have, but the strong owner role of managing the money, protecting taxpayer investments, and making sure that the project gets done on time and on budget. We also learned that the successful projects brought in the environmental agencies very early. They brought in those folks and with us, the tribes in both Oregon and Washington, anybody who had a permitting or a consultation role has been with this project now from the beginning. The more they know about what we considered, what we tried to do, on what design features we had, how we might avoid things that they know we should avoid, we've been working that through our design concepts as we go along. And then scope and budget tracking and rigorous cost estimating are the things that we put in place in Washington back in 2002, and it has really benefited us on the delivery of not just major projects, but other projects. We were successful in 2003 and 2005 in having revenue increases that our legislature supported, and it amassed the investment of capital projects on highways to about $15 billion. It's a 23-year investment time, but we are delivering those projects now. Our legislature, I looked at the list that Matt had of your investment package for the 35 projects. For those projects picked 391 projects with that investment and have us tracking very much like you are, quarterly reporting on the delivery of those projects. We've now delivered or have under construction 309 of the 391. And so we're working our way through those packages. And we believe that early and often communication, clear transparency on the use of the money, how the investments are going, are all a way to build public credibility and support for future investments along our way. Part of that is how well we do on delivering projects within scope and estimate. We delivered a method which we call CVIP, Cost Estimating Validation Procedure, and it's a kind of a funny name for a very simple concept that has served us well and we're applying also on the Columbia River Crossing. It's to use cost risk estimating as you develop your projects. You start with your base cost of a project. What should this project cost as you're designing it if everything went well? Then you start looking at the risks you might encounter and what the costs of those risks if you have to manage it. Subsurface materials that might be all bad. What might that cost you? If you have a tribal cultural resource that you uncover, what might that cost to the project? What kind of utility problem, labor delay, all of those things we add into our estimates. And on a major project, of course, you can imagine it's really a very big and comprehensive process. But then you start looking at, and we have some it's called Monte Carlo estimating. I don't entirely understand it myself, but we use the process to say, what if some of those risks actually happen? Now that we've identified them, the job is to manage our way through them. Once you've identified something, you certainly can manage it better. But we use that to build a better estimate of what your project might cost. There is nothing that the public hates worse than if we don't assume something might go wrong and have an estimate that gets blown partway through the design or partway through the construction. So we're using a tool like that in the state of Washington and on this project to make sure that when we put ranges of cost estimates out for the public and for you to consider, we're going to be reporting on those, talking about which risks we encounter, how we're managing our way through those, and give folks a better sense as we move through the project how we're doing on staying within the budgets that have been placed. I'd like to talk just a little bit about the communications. You can never communicate enough on projects. What we've learned and what we try to do is talk to folks, first of all, plainly so that they can understand and to relate the project to the impact within their community. One of the issues around Columbia River Crossing, as you know, is when you blend the Clark County, Vancouver side with the Portland side, sometimes cultural differences, but everybody wants a good outcome for this project. And they want a project that fits within the context of their community. So we are talking to neighborhoods, businesses, both ports on each side of the river, and working hard to make sure that we hear everybody's input as we think about what the design of this bridge will look like, how many ramps there are, how the connections work, so that it's something that really is a pride to the community in the future. We have, helping us, a Project Sponsors Council that came out of the larger task force that Matt talked about, but a smaller group, the two co-chairs of the task force graciously agreed to stay on as citizen representatives, Henry Hewitt from Oregon and Hal Dingerink from Washington. They're guiding us and the cities of Portland, Vancouver. The two mayors sit on that board, TriMet and CTRAN as the transit agencies. Metro and Southwest Washington MPO are also at the table. And the goal is to, as the governors appointed this group, is to have local advisory and decision-making that is supported as we make decisions on the project, as we move forward on how this project will go. We know how our communities feel. And we're trying to build a project through consensus if we can, but a project that will serve not only the communities, but the region, both states, and the nation as we move forward. And in closing, before Richard comes up, we just wanted to point out that we think this is going to be a national model. I mentioned to you it's a high-capacity transit corridor as well as a bridge. We've looked around to see what kinds of projects are being built in the country now. I can't find one that looks like ours. We are planning to have light rail connect to the TriMet system coming through to Vancouver on this bridge. We'll have lanes for freight and add drop lanes that will serve the interchanges that are so close to the bridge itself and the river itself that will serve the businesses and the communities, and we believe will become a much safer facility as we move forward. This DOTs and large projects in urban areas like this no longer just build a project and walk away. This is a project that will be very heavily managed through a performance-based management system. It's very important to us to maintain the criteria of safety, of mobility, access for the businesses, and for just general freight and passenger movement through this corridor. A lot of bottlenecks on I-5, and we see this as the biggest one that remains to be conquered. We are working hard to have a bridge that will not be an eyesore, but an asset, as Matt said. And we're working hard to make this a sustainable bridge. We're learning a lot more these days about the kinds of materials you can use, not only to have a long, safe, and healthy facility or structure, but one that is also easy on the environment. And we're working hard to be that national model of one that we can declare is a well-operated, well-built, and well-functioning and productive facility. So thank you. I will ask Richard Brandman to talk a little bit about where we are on the status of the project as we move forward.
Thank you, Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, members of the committee. It's also a pleasure for me to be here today. I'm Richard Brandman. I'm the Oregon director of the project. What I wanted to do first is just give you a quick overview of what the project actually consists of. It's not just a bridge. It's a 5.5-mile-long corridor, a couple of miles on either side of the bridge. It includes 7 tightly spaced interchanges. Why that's significant here, those tightly spaced interchanges have very high volumes. Those very high volumes create a lot of mixing of cars and trucks trying to get on and off the facility, which creates lots of congestion and lots of accidents that you've already heard about. There's over 50 structures that are involved in this project, primarily overpasses. The project itself would include a replacement bridge over the Columbia, highway improvements in that 5-mile vicinity. Bicycle and pedestrian facilities would be greatly improved, as you've heard previously. There'd be much, much better access to the ports on either side of the river, and there would be light rail as part of this project. Overall, as projects evolve, their cost estimates evolve. We constantly look for ways to try and achieve the same benefits at a lower cost. That's typically done through processes called value engineering. The value engineering has taken place on this project several times already. It will also take place continually as we move forward. Additionally, in June, our Project Sponsors Council asked us to take a look at, are there other elements of this project that we might possibly be able to, for example, defer and not build as part of the initial construction project? Are there elements of the project that we could potentially reuse as opposed to tearing down and rebuilding? And we were doing all that trying to be mindful of, number one, lowering the project's overall cost, but still meeting its overall purpose and need. Because, for example, every movement on every interchange isn't needed on opening day. But it is important to ensure that the primary objectives of the project are being met on opening day for those things that are pressing problems today. After 5 months of meetings with our partners, as well as looking at every, basically, foot of this project from end to end, we released a recommendation last week that will be considered by our Project Sponsors Council in early December. The recommendation would actually reduce the overall project cost by about $650 million. That's an overall 20% reduction in the highway portion of the project alone. Funding has certainly been a topic that we have been addressing seriously, and I today would like to explain a little bit about the concepts that are moving forward. The funding that's being proposed is from a three-legged stool, essentially. One leg, the federal government. Two, the two states of Oregon and Washington, and third, from tolls. Let me start first on the federal front. We are pursuing two sources of federal funding. One is from the FTA New Starts funding pot. That's the pot of money that actually funds light rail projects. And I'm happy to tell you that with the assistance of our congressional delegation, and particularly to Senator Murray and Congressman DeFazio, they've made it much easier through language that's moving its way through Congress for us to achieve upwards of $800 million of funding for the light rail project. We are also pursuing projects of national significance funding for the roadway portion. That's a committee that Congressman DeFazio also chairs, and we're seeking upwards of $400 million of funding from that particular source. With respect to tolls, we have a tolling study that's underway today, and there are several steps to go before a toll rate is settled on. But the range of funds that could be available from tolls range from anywhere from $1 billion to $1.4 billion. So there is a significant amount of potential funding for this project, and then the two states would be examining ways to also fund the remaining gap between the total project cost and the result of the funding that we receive from these two other sources. So our funding plan will be finalized when our designs are finalized, when there's agreement on what the scope of the project is, what the mitigation plans are, what the final cost estimate for the project are, et cetera, et cetera. We have a range of costs right now, and that range of costs reflects where we are in the process. We're still in the environmental stage. It reflects that there are still decisions to be made and that there are still is engineering to be done to understand the full implications of building this project. These photos show you basically the design of the bridge that is moving forward. There was an urban design advisory committee that made recommendations to the project. It was composed of broad representation from throughout both sides of the Portland-Vancouver metro area. And the design that's moving forward, I think, is a pretty innovative design. It's two bridges moving forward, not three. We had originally envisioned three bridges, a northbound for traffic, a southbound for traffic, and a separate light rail bridge. In this instance, we're able to save money by doing two bridges instead of three bridges and hanging the light rail on the bottom deck of one of the bridges and the bicycle and pedestrian path on the bottom deck of the other bridge. So the committee felt they were nice-looking bridges, but they're certainly not extravagant. They're very cost-effective. The project, as I mentioned, will also include light rail. Today, the light rail in Portland stops at the Expo Center, just short of the Columbia River. With this proposal, the light rail would be extended from the last station in North Portland to Hayden Island, then across the Columbia River, and through downtown Vancouver, ending at a park and ride lot in Clark County itself. Next steps. We're moving at a good pace through the analysis that we're doing. We all wish that it could go faster, I think, but there are lots of issues, and we're spending lots of time with the community resolving these issues. We expect the final environmental impact statement to be completed next June or July. Following that, the federal government will issue what's called a record of decision, which concludes the environmental process. We would then start buying right-of-way in 2011, start construction in 2012, and we estimate it would be about a six-year construction period, finishing in the year 2018. So with that, I think our presentation is done, and we'd be happy to try and answer questions.
Okay, thank you. I do have a few going back in your slides on the seven tightly spaced interchanges. Can you give me an idea, since I can't read the scale, it's too small there for me, give me an idea of, in terms of miles, of, we say tightly spaced, about how tight are they?
They're about a half a mile between those interchanges.
Half a mile between the interchanges on the interstate.
You would normally want about 2 mile spacing between those interchanges.
Okay, and do most of those interchanges have then traffic coming off, going onto I-5, as well as people anticipating going off on the interchange up ahead from I-5?
That's correct, Senator Metzger, members of the committee. That's correct. There are enormous amount of volumes at those interchanges, approaching 1,500 to 2,000 vehicles an hour getting on and off, many of them going onto the main line, many of them also going off, getting off at the following interchanges.
And those inevitably statistically create conflicts with cars, correct?
That is correct.
Which is why you want, you know, larger than half a mile to do that. But I would assume then your engineering has been able to say, because the project itself is important and these accesses are important, that you are engineering it to be able to mitigate those conflicts to such an extent that it's important to maintain those interchanges. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
That's what I thought. Thank you. I had another question. Oh, on the tolling issue, and I just kind of thought about this a little bit, especially with the light rail, that once the light rail is produced, you know, you always, like everything else, have the issue of how the cost is going to be paid to actually operate the light rail. And when you and I drive a car, we're paying for that part of it, but now someone else we have to pay to do that. Has there been any thought about tolling for the passengers on the light rail, and in that case it would be a toll that would be embedded in the cost of whatever the light rail ticket is, that would be to help go towards the operational side of the light rail?
The decision to operate light rail on the bridge will come from the Clark County voters, who will actually have to pass a referendum to tax themselves to create the operations of the light rail. So in essence, you could think of it that they will be paying a toll. Countywide, they'll be paying a toll or a tax, to create and operate the light rail. And we are hoping that through FTA's generous New Starts program, we'll be able to get the capital investment for the light rail across the bridge with federal money. So we've not talked about that. We don't have that kind of an example in Washington State. What we do have are a lot of bus rapid transit and express bus routes across our bridges that we're contemplating tolling on. And the big discussion there has been whether or not to toll the buses. As you encourage people to use high-capacity transit, should you let the buses go free? And it's a huge debate within our legislature right now, so stay tuned on how that might come out in the next year or two.
Well, the point on that is, and I'm not saying it's the right approach or not, it's just one that's just I thought about, and that is that particularly in public transit, we're always struggling in every jurisdiction to provide the operational costs.
Right.
Some people have that problem with building jails and can't find people to operate. I mean, it's just, you know, you have to look at this whole thing about to make it work and the cost, and that those costs will increase, as well as maintaining the infrastructure or building the infrastructure and then maintaining that. So whether it's busing or whether it's, say, light rail, we have found the funding methods, and of course, in the metro area, you know, there's the business tax that pays for the TriMet tax, et cetera. And when those costs are needed, then they come to the legislature, as they would in Washington, asking to increase that base. And that's done because there's been a lot of work over the years about the benefits that are associated with that, and therefore a natural participation. But at the same standpoint, that may not be the only one to look at, may not be proper to say that's the only source that needs to continue to be raised. And I'm just thinking that the core belief that's been around for a long time on transportation is that user pays. And so I always think that to the extent that the user can feel some sense of contributory actions towards that, I think makes all the other payers feel a little bit better. And it's not going to pay for the whole thing, but if you have a bus pass that is a buck, you know, just to make up, throw it, you know, to go on light rail from, you know, Hayden Island over to, you know, Clark County, and it's now that bus pass is $1.10, and that 10 is the quote toll to help maintain the operations of that. At least there's a user pay element in there that I think, when you ask the businesses and everybody else to raise theirs, that they're not alone subsidizing that. I just think that when you get into the funding sources of the operational side, you know, may be valuable.
Yeah.
The only thing I would add, Senator Metzger, is that as the operating plans and revenue needs are considered, the user's fare revenue will also be considered in that mix. And I won't speak for CTRAN or TriMet, but they will come to an agreement at some point down the road on what's the appropriate fare for a passenger using the transit system across the river. And all of that revenue, in essence, is a user pay to help finance the operations of the system. So the vote would not be for the entire operations. It would be to supplement, in large part, the CTRAN needs for their their system, as well as running the light rail across the river.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, we've actually had tolling outreach meetings, taking some lessons from Washington's experience. We've come down here, Paul and I, as well as the chairs of both our commissions, sat on it. And I will tell you, this is not an unfamiliar suggestion. I mean, the bottom line is a trip's a trip, getting to the user pay. So, again, as we move forward, and as the legislature up in the state of Washington vets this issue and will inform it and direct, our commission has the authority here on the Oregon side. I want you to know that from the secretary and the director's perspective, we've heard that from constituents who came to these tolling outreach meetings, and then the chairs of both committees, or excuse me, commissions have heard that as well. So,
questions? Senator George.
The biggest criticism I've heard, and thank you for coming today, by the way, the biggest criticism I've heard of this entire project is that I think most citizens of the region believe that the taking all the traffic and running it into two basic crossings in the Vancouver-Portland metro area was inadequate. So the whole idea of a bridge, most people had in their minds a third bridge for safety purposes, for separating traffic, for getting alternative routes, all those types of things. What we're ending up with through a series of decisions that have happened over the last 5 years is basically a replacement bridge option for $3.5 billion. That train has, I guess, left the station. At the end of the day, though, when this project is complete, we spent $3.5 billion, we're still only going to have two bridges that connect Vancouver and Portland in one of the most busy thoroughfares in the entire country. And when you look out in the future, how then do you justify ultimately getting to a third bridge option? I think that's the political thing it's difficult for decision makers to make is that you guys have gone through this entire vetting process and you've had all these work groups, but the public is out here going, we're going to spend $3.5 billion and we're going to have a replacement bridge? That seems kind of ridiculous. And I understand it within all these work groups that have turned around. My personal belief is that light rail has sort of wagged this dog, meaning to get a light rail bridge across the Columbia, we've done this replacement bridge option. But how do we go back to our constituents and say, we're going to spend $3.5 billion and we're going to get a replacement bridge, and then what is the future for a third bridge, which I think people from a safety perspective, from a transit perspective, from a freight perspective, is definitely needed. Look long term. Are we 50 years from a third bridge option?
I think if, Mr. Chairman, Senator George, legitimate issues that have been placed on the table, and again, they were part of that vetting process. I mean, the third bridge alternative was actually found to have merit. But the reason we were going to replace the existing infrastructure is because the transportation infrastructure and industry have grown up around the I-5 corridor. That's where significant investment has been made. And again, you have bridges that don't work. They are unsafe. You will have a better functioning facility as well as the interchanges that connect those bridges. So as the conversation went, sure, has merit. One of the early deficits, going back to 99-2000 time frame, one of the early deficits identified is, boy, you only have two crossings. You look at other cities, and they have at least handfuls of crossings. So we're disadvantaged right from the get-go here. That factored into it and said, listen, this third bridge concept is a concept with merit, but let us take care of where the infrastructure has been built around. Let us make sure we have a better functioning and a safer bridge. And then let's turn our attention. So is it on the horizon? Sure. And there's a significant voice behind the third bridge, mostly to the west, not so much to the east, but they were all looked at as we started vetting all those alternatives. So it is a future conversation. It makes some sense. I think we're better positioned as a region if we get more crossings. But, you know, one multi-billion dollar offer effort at a time, I guess, is really where we stand.
follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. I guess here's the, when I look at transit across the river, which we clearly have many people who work in Oregon and live in Vancouver for a series of reasons. We have a huge transit issue between the two where we have commuters coming across choke points. And the reason why I'm a little frustrated, I guess, with sort of how this decision-making process goes through, again, it seems like to me both the third bridge option and then the transit alternatives that were considered were driven by a narrow view that we are going to have a light rail option. And so, for instance, when you look at the light rail option, for the operational space of the pedestrian and light rail option, you could have dedicated bus routes. So a light rail option will give you 2,000 people per hour through a choke point. That's your choke point, 2,000 people per hour, where a dedicated bus route would get you 20,000 to 30,000 people across that same valuable space on that bridge. So even if you go to this particular crossing, it seems like to me the most wise transit alternative would be to have high-capacity bus routes that would be dedicated to buses, and you could move 20,000, 30,000 people an hour, where under a light rail system, you're sitting here talking about maybe 2,000 people per hour at peak, which means that you've, in essence, confined this huge addition to this bridge to be a choke point of where only 2,000 transit riders per hour could use. To me, I don't understand how these things come up, because I'm just looking from functionality.
Yeah.
I like the third bridge option. Didn't happen. Okay, I'm willing to go with that. So now we're talking about a transit alternative. I want to move tens of thousands of people across that bridge. I want a dedicated bus route that can move lots of people in very flexible methods. And now it seems like the train has also left the station again on this idea that we're dedicated on a light rail line that could only move 2,000 people per hour. And that just frustrates the living daylights out of me, because how do you defend that? So general discussion of how we come to these decisions.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, there were many transit options examined as this process moved forward. The option you're discussing was considered, which is called bus rapid transit or express buses. Commuter rail was looked at, high-speed rail was looked at, streetcars. And the task force itself, the 39-person task force, I think it was unanimously or nearly unanimously recommended the light rail moving forward, and it was recommended for several reasons. One is the infrastructure actually required to do dedicated bus lanes was very costly, because it wasn't just getting the buses across the Columbia River, which would require an even wider bridge with more lanes to get the buses into a dedicated lane, but then you had to reconstruct I-5 all the way from Vancouver into Portland to have that dedicated bus lane. And when you compared that against extending the light rail that already went to the Columbia River, it was actually more cost-effective to take the light rail across the river than to add more lanes to the bridge and then reconstruct the freeway into Portland. And the light rail actually has operating efficiencies as compared to the buses in terms of the driver who would be on a light rail train that can carry 300 passengers as opposed to a standard bus, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think, 60 to 70 passengers. So there's operating efficiencies that were considered by the transit agencies as they signed on as well to the recommendation to move forward with light rail, because it actually results in a lower operating cost for them.
Mr. Fuller. Richard, I guess I'd need to see that report, because I've thumbed through it, and I don't see that justification. Meaning, I understand the option was put on the table and quickly dismissed. I mean, the fact is that you're right. One bus hauls 60 people, but you move so many more buses per hour across the same amount of space. We've seen this in places like Brazil and all over the world. There's places where they use dedicated bus routes, and exactly the same right-of-way that you use for light rail, you could use in exactly the same way for dedicated buses. And all I'm saying is that what I'm really afraid of is that if you look at an entire process like this, third bridge, light rail, it all seems to be driven by a group of people who want to move 2,500 people per hour on the light rail, and all of our transportation decisions are being made based off of an outcome-based decision-making process, meaning we have an outcome-based decision-making process that we want to have light rail across it. And so all of our freight, all of our transit, all of our moving people, livability issues are all driven off this one basic foundation. And if you can get me a report that actually talks about that, I saw the paperwork. It looked like I didn't see any study that actually justified that there was a transit alternative review that I felt like was thorough, because to me, this is a huge missed opportunity to move a lot of people across. Even if we just go with the replacement bridge option here, you move a lot more people across that bridge, and you would increase livability, you would reduce traffic, you would ease the flow if we could move more transit riders across with an alternative in mass transit that works rather than one just because we've built the infrastructure. And if you get me a study on that, I'd appreciate it, because every study I've seen, that doesn't say that. I mean, we've had the presentations here again, and I still, nobody has ever gotten to me in my desk a justification. That's what I'm saying.
If I may, Chairman Metzger, Senator George, because I guess I don't subscribe that it was the light rail tail wagging the dog. Again, this was a robust conversation. We'll certainly get you the analysis, the evaluation, how we arrived, where we arrived, and we'll walk through that with you. But I just can't subscribe. I will tell you it was a robust discussion amongst the 39. As we vetted it, we took in cultural issues. Paula suggested earlier that's a reality of this. Senator Starr mentioned the political issues. There are overlays on every conversation we have. We can't deny that. We looked at the operational cost, those type of things. How do the transit districts function? That was all into play. We'll articulate that with the paperwork we have, but I just would be remiss if I didn't say we're just not going to agree on what drove this process. It was laid out on the table, and we arrived where we arrived with, again, the depth and breadth of transportation interests pushing and pulling.
Matt, I'd say if I could, is that your staff, I think, has dealt very well with the process. I'm not saying there's no criticism of your staff. I think the last thing you said, which is the political implications, ultimately your staff is forced to deal with those political implications. And what I'm saying is that from the rest of us in the state, we have to deal with the political implications of what Portland does, and that drove a light rail option, which is driving the entire process. And all I'm saying is that for the rest of us who we're going to be asked to vote for supporting funding for this project, it's very difficult. Your staff has to deal with that political ramification. The rest of us then have to deal with the political ramification on the flip side of that, which is, does this make sense for the rest of the state to spend these types of resources on a decision that may have been politically driven rather than factually driven that I think your staff wanted to get at? And so there no criticism of your staff. I actually think that you're right. It's a political process or a problem.
I appreciate that. And again, I look forward to the conversations where we can lay that on the table and we'll share our story.
Senator Verger, then Senator Schrader.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Hammond, welcome today. Very nice to have you. I guess that what I want to talk about, the reality of things, I think that Senator George has brought up some very interesting points. I'm sure that those points came up in your discussions. Thank you for the long hours of just never-ending meetings that obviously some of you have been through in order to reach this point. And certainly the need is there. But I just want to raise an issue with you that I think is quite new. One of the things that you have to have is maximum ridership or maximum passenger cars coming across, and that requires jobs. So as the economy has fallen and we are seeing fewer jobs, you have fewer people coming from Vancouver commuting. And unless we can do something that maintains the level of economic development in Oregon and in Washington for the people in Oregon that go to Washington to work, then you're in trouble, because what you're basing it on is maximum. You're thinking 135,000, they're all coming here, and that's great, and we want them to keep coming back and forth. But I'm just saying that in an economy like we have now, and it may get worse, that those jobs, as they fall, you're going to have fewer riders and fewer passengers coming across.
Senator, the one issue that we keep coming back to is the economic connection of this corridor, not just to the region, but to the states, and we contend the nation, which is why we're trying to convince our delegation this is a national issue that we need financial help with. But what we know in parts all over, especially urban congestion, choke points and bottlenecks on our transportation system, is we're hearing that it inhibits the growth and the continuation of businesses in urban areas. So we want this project to remove that bottleneck, provide good access for both of our ports and the business community that has been staunchly supporting the improvement on this corridor, that we can then have and not be the reason for the economic problem, but to facilitate and enhance that. So we agree. I think that it's very important that this project can help spur and help us recover in the economy.
That's great.
First of all, I want to thank you for all of you for being here today. It's a pleasure to see you, and welcome to Oregon. And I also want to give a personal thanks for the briefing I received from ODOT prior to this meeting today about this particular project. And I may be a little politically incorrect here, so I'm going to state that up front. We've talked about transit issues, bus, light rail. I think we can continue to have the discussion of the efficacy of what moves more people faster. Certainly, I'd like to see that information. But as we discuss this project, what is striking to me is the notion of commerce, moving freight, moving people to jobs, moving goods and services. And then we have this bike ped component, and what seems to me in an area where the real major focus seems to be quickly moving goods and services, keeping this corridor that is essential for the economic vitality of the West Coast open. Now, I am certainly have been a proponent of bike ped, but is there any information realistically on a project of this scope and size? With these bike ped connectors, who uses them? How much are they used? Are people really going to be in this huge corridor that's really moving a lot of folks in a lot of different directions? Is there data that indicates that's even a choice? When I want to do bike ped, I want to, quite frankly, do it in a little more of a bucolic environment. And I know that there are designs that do that along transportation corridors, but the size and scope of this, I guess I'm trying to tease out if cost is an issue, what is the cost of this, and is it a component, given what the real focus is of the project, is it a component that is going to have to happen?
Richard has
please.
Chair Metzger and Senator Schrader, we've worked closely with the bicycle community as we've developed the plans for this project. And as Director Garrett has said earlier, the existing bicycle and pedestrian facilities are horrible. And they're probably in the neighborhood of 500 trips per day are coming across the bridge right now on bicycles. That's limited by how difficult it is to find the facility and then how difficult it is to even use the facility once you're on it. And the proposal that's moving forward, we estimate there'll be upwards of 5,000 bicyclists a day using the facility when there's actually a decent facility and the connectors to that facility. So that's how we're proposing to move forward with this, and we're again saving resource by having the bicycle facilities on the lower deck of this bridge.
And I would add to Senator Metzger's question, in our tolling outreach, we've heard quite a bit of comment from folks saying, are the bikes going to pay a toll? And so there's an issue to discuss and consider. And when you talk about user pay, even though it's great for the environment that they're biking, it's great for their personal health, if it's a commuter choice, there's a question on whether or not bicycles should have a transponder tag on their helmets and whether they should be counted as well. So it'll be an interesting debate.
Follow-up, Chair? Again, what I would like, if you would be so kind, because I know there must be projects across the country of this size and scope that have included this component, and much like Senator George, I just would like to see the numbers of, and you gave me some, I just want to make sure that as I do my due diligence as this project moves forward, and it does have, at least from my conversations with the business community, because of, again, the movement of freight services, job creation, getting people to where they need to go to work, it seems to have broad support from the business community, but I would like to get the data dealing with this component, and it must be out there from other areas of the country where we've seen an increase. How safe has it been? Are people using it? And again, what kind of design? I mean, are people just kind of riding and walking across concrete, or are there, you know, where are they landing if they choose to use this kind of facility with a project of this scope and size? So if you could get me that information, I'd appreciate it.
Two questions. Senator Starr.
Thank you. I appreciate you being here today. The question that I have, or the concern that I have, is the reduction in the size of the capacity of the bridge to move people, the reduction from 12 lanes to 10 lanes. I happen to have my computer up here, and the crossing Columbia River Crossing Coalition has a pretty simple diagram on their website that really outlines the what those extra lanes, that extra lane moving from 10 to 12 does. I mean, it's, and my understanding, the cost reductions and the big overall scope of the project is minimal to move from 10 to 12, and yet the ability to impact congestion and safety by having these dedicated lanes that allow for access to and from Hayden Island to SR 14 and from downtown Vancouver to Hayden Island on each side of the bridge. You know, by eliminating those accesses, by eliminating that additional lane, you're going to have more weaving, more folks merging in and then back out as they try to get off at those first interchanges on each side of the river. I'm concerned about that. I think it's the wrong approach. I think it's an approach that's going to cost lives, because people are going to die because they're going to be in crashes. And for $25 million in a project that's over $3 billion, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, especially when, you know, they bring up the issues that Senator Schrader just talked about. How many tens of millions of dollars are we going to spend so we can make it nice for people to walk and bike across the bridge? I understand the drive to make it easier for people to walk and bike across the bridge. In fact, when you look at the investment that's been made both in Hayden Island and on the Vancouver side of the river with the condos and the development that's occurred east of the bridge, I can make, you know, if I'm living there, and, you know, living on the river is a nice thing, you know. There's positives to that. But we're going to spend tens of millions of dollars to move potentially 5,000 people, and we're going to reduce the bridge size and scope by a lane, and these lanes are only not in a continuous lane for the whole 5 miles, but just on the, particularly just on the bridge itself. People are going to die because we're going to not spend $25 million to make it more safe for them to get on and off, and there's going to be the weavings, so they're going to continue to have the crashes that are going to cause the congestion and the backup. So that's my first question, and I'd like to have you address that, and then I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Once you walk through the refining and configuration, how we got where we got.
Okay. Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, we've looked carefully at the need for lanes across the river, and as we've gone through this process, we've reached a conclusion that you can safely construct this facility at 10 lanes. And as we've looked around, including Secretary Hammond can speak to this in Seattle, the facility size is important, but the way the facility is actually constructed is equally important. And so as we've gone through the refinement process, the safety issue has been top of mind. And so the configuration of the 10 lanes that would be going across the bridge does allow for safely merging onto and off of the facility. It's not the quick merge on-off that you have today. There's good merge lanes that have tapers that allow for safe access onto and off of the facility. And so as the projects move forward with its giant task of trying to reduce the overall cost and bring the project down to a budget that we feel we can reasonably afford, we've kept safety top of mind and feel that this proposal is a great proposal in terms of moving people efficiently as well as safely.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, just to maybe be a little more blunt. You can compare it from 12 to 10. I work the other way, to be very honest with you. I know what we have now. And if indeed we do breathe life into this structure, we will make it a safer bridge for folks. It's what you can do. I mean, that's just the challenge before us. With the financial realities, the technical realities, the political realities, I want to breathe life into a bridge. And if I can do that, I make it a safer bridge than what exists right now. Because there is a cost of inaction. There's no question. And I migrate up rather than migrate down because I know what's happening today. And I know what's at jeopardy in terms of the traveling public, in terms of the crashes, the injuries. Some fatalities, not a whole lot. They're not going fast enough to hurt each other badly, but there are injuries there. But I know if I extend out and I breathe life in this new facility, I have made it safer. It functions much more efficient for both those people as well as the freight and commerce.
Well, I would disagree. I mean, for the $25 million you're going to have and the thousands of crashes that you're going to eliminate from the bridge over the life of the bridge, it makes no sense to cut off our nose to spite our face and save $25 million when we can save tens of, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars in cost as it relates to what a crash does on that bridge. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
Senator, if I could just add, one of the things we've looked at, and I heard you talking to Doug Tindall earlier about, is it reasonable design or
practical
design, excuse me. This is, in essence, the same kind of thing. It's not what is the gold-plated Cadillac you could build, but what is the project, what is the design in the project that meets the best and most of your objectives of the project. And safety is number one for us and for Federal Highway. So to not compromise safety. Safety is a standard and a thing that we have said that we will not do. But one of the things we've looked at very carefully is on day of opening, this new concept of the reduction is to have 10 lanes on the bridge. But building the structure wide enough so as not to preclude a future 11th and 12th lane to facilitate good, safe traffic in the future when that buildup becomes necessary. And that's part of this concept.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair, on another issue. I'm interested in the tolling and the management of congestion. The concern I have is that if you manage congestion on the bridge but don't manage congestion downstream, you end up not managing congestion on the bridge. And I just throw that out there for your comment.
Well, Chairman Metzger, Senator Starr, it's an excellent question. Again, and the realities are we are, for all intents and purposes, reintroducing tolling to Oregonians at this new structure. It's been a while since folks threw literally the quarters into the booth. That said, so you have to secure a beachhead, and there will be not only the basic tolling, but we'll have some dynamic pricing, congestion pricing, and that's a management tool. I think we secure the beachhead first, but you're right. It's a transportation system. And I think the language that you and your colleagues placed in House Bill 2001 has us stepping back and look at the whole of the system. How do you manage the system? But I guess I would submit to you that, again, let's secure a beachhead. I think Columbia River Crossing offers the greatest hope. The efforts that we'll engage in with the Portland metro area and these congestion pricing pilots will allow us to look at a greater expanse of opportunity. It is the future. That's my statement. I think we need to do it. We need to truly make sure we are building on solid foundations, so we need to be prudent as we move forward and understand what the motivations are, understand exactly how we do this without stumbling, because if we do indeed stumble early on, I think we blemish opportunities for a long time. I think that's the opportunity that you provided with the pilot, and we look forward and we embrace with our partners up in Portland to have that conversation. So, and we are having that conversation. I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to share exactly where we are on that effort because it's close. This is about how you manage a transportation system.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Berger.
I want to go back to the bicycle concept because I agree that if it's a user fee, those who have bicycles, because I just want to throw out this comment that all of us have to pay registration for our automobiles, and yet we still have yet to require any kind of registration fee on bicycles, and we've provided bike lanes throughout the state of Oregon on our highways, and they've paid nothing into that process. And so I think that you get where you build more and more animosity, and there are good things about people riding bikes, and I don't think people intend to have it as a personal thing, but it is not fair. And so I think that there should be some resolution to that.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, the timing has been absolutely perfect because Representative Kokotec has just walked in as the panel has ended. Pretty amazing. And colleagues, we have some written testimony from Representative Kokotec, and we're sure whether we would be finished by the time she was able to attend, but it turns out it's perfect. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. And for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of the Columbia River Crossing. I'm sure you've gotten a lot of your questions answered. You've been at this for a little bit, I think. I won't go through my testimony. I hope you have a chance to read it. The one thing I get asked most when I bring up this topic with my constituents is, when are we going to start this? We're on track. If we can keep the cost refinements that have been proposed on track and meet that window of federal funding, we could start in 2012, which from my perspective and the perspective of folks in my district, that's a really good thing. Whether it's congestion, freight mobility, safety, that light rail to Vancouver, better bike ped access, all of those things, everybody in my district, the vast majority wants that to happen. And I think it's just up to us to help keep it on track. I've been very impressed with what the CRC team has been doing about looking at trying to bring down the cost a bit. The phasing for the exchanges I think is the right way to go. I think some of the reengineering we've done around trying to figure out what the actual cost with the bridge over the Columbia will be in terms of, you know, I think you probably heard about how they've looked at, you know, the substructure is better than we thought. We can get the price down. We're on the right track. And all I would say is let's keep it on track. Let's talk about tolling. Let's talk about that as the local contribution to this. And I think we can make that happen, but that's going to take us talking about it and why that's important. We all know that bridge used to be tolled not that long ago. But at the end of the day, people want this to happen. And just want to hope you'll be with me on that one and keep working forward on it. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Representative Kotek, and especially since from a citizen standpoint, it represents those who are most impacted by that. You know, going back into the 50s, you know, while I was quite small back then, I do remember hearing even in the 60s, you know, a lot of concerns about the neighborhood back then because of I-5, of disrupting and dismantling, you know, neighborhood long-term ties. And, you know, the work that's been done since then to and try and, you know, re-energize those community connections. And so when something like this comes along, you know, I mean, it's easy to say deja vu all over again. Then, of course, the other hand being the opportunity then to take a lot of the negative impacts that have happened over years because of this and to make the community better, as you mentioned in your letter, in terms of congestion, access, and everything else. And so I think your support is extremely important, and I've been very, very pleased to hear about those who live, reside, and work in North Portland also see this as a project that is very important. So your leadership on this is really, really important.
Thank you, Senator.
Questions for Representative Kotek while we have her here?
Come visit. I'll give you a tour. Come visit.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Just a couple of things before we close out. We're going to get out a little early, which is a good thing. I mean, most of us have afternoon committees. Well, maybe our January date. Has that been set, Patrick?
It has. Let me just pull that up real quick. I believe it's the Thursday of the January.
And this will be a joint committee, as I recall.
Yes, January 13th. It's actually Wednesday the 13th in the afternoon.
Okay. That'll be that. In terms of committee bills, I didn't hear from any member about any request for committee bills. I introduced two, one of which is a collection of technical fixes for 2001 and other things, none of which should be anything controversial, just to make sure that some of the things that we overlooked on that, the language is actually correct. So that'll be one piece of legislation. The other one that I introduced is another very small bill dealing with the operational structure of the Willamette River Cleanup Authority that was established in 2003, but there's some operational issues, and so changing some of the memberships and the ability to get that more functional. So that's all we have there. And yes,
one of my personal bills might affect something. My apologies to Director Garrett that I haven't had an opportunity to tell him, but it's one of the Buy American, so that's in the project, that it takes priority on American-made products. So that would be one thing that would fall into his bill.
Okay, sounds good. Anything else for the good or the order?
No, I do apologize. I had to step out, so I will loop back with folks to get a quick debriefing on our committee bills.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, with that, thank you for your attendance and your adjournment.